My name is Arn Westlund. I'm one of the directors of LSE Ideas. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this book launch for Sergei Radchenko's new book. One of his new books, I should say. Because Sergei is so productive that he puts all the rest of us to shame in terms of how much he is actually publishing. He had one book out last year with Campbell Craig, The Atomic Bomb and the Origins of the Cold War, that Yale University Press published, to wide acclaim, it must be said, already. He has also been working on a number of other projects. I'm sure we'll mention them in brief when he speaks. In addition to that, of course, Sergei has a particular significance here for the LSE. He's been here as an LSE fellow for 2 years, teaching in the International History Department and also contributing very importantly to LSE Ideas in many, many different ways. He is someone who has done more than anyone I know of his generation in order to help open up Russian archives. And what he's done on that is really fantastic. It is the argument that I often use when I hear that Soviet-era archives are inaccessible. I always refer them to Sergei's work. It's hard work. I mean, it's difficult to do. It's not easy. But he is the one that more than anyone else who has worked in this field has proven that it is possible still to do good, solid work based on international archives, but with Russian archives being a very important part of it. So in that sense, Sergei has done a lot of work for all of us and not just for his own research. And that is something that I appreciate. I've known Sergei for many years. He worked with me for his PhD thesis, which this book is one of the products to come out of. I think there might be several over time. Sergei is originally from Sakhalin in the far east of Russia, which I think explains at least in part some of his preoccupation with East Asia in general. He's been working a lot on Mongolian history. Sergei first came to Mongolia because we thought there would be fantastic materials there that no one else had looked at. And he stayed for 3 years, was it? Roughly? Something like that. Taught himself perfect Mongolian. Got a Mongolian girlfriend, now his wife. And is, of course, working on a book on Mongolian history as well that you may want to talk about a little bit later. And this, of course, is just what he does when he's not fishing or climbing mountains or doing other things that he enjoys doing. So this is a book, the one that we are presenting today. It's a Stanford University Press publication. That's not just the product of great research and a fascinating topic. It's also a product in a way of a great romance in Coming to Mongolia. It's a product of a very different kind of approach to international history from what one generally sees. Because it is not just international history. It is also history that deals with a very broad set of historiographical points. And I think I'm not much mistaken in saying that this is the main impact that the book is going to have. It's one of those books that takes a field that we thought we knew something about and really turns it upside down. It's wonderfully revisionist in terms of its approach. And that, I think, is, in a way, the best introduction that one historian can give to another. So, Sergei, it's a great pleasure to have you here. I'll be looking forward to listening.
Thank you for a wonderful introduction. of course, the more I'm working with you, the more I find out about myself from all these wonderful introductions.
I keep inventing things as we move along.
Right. As you'll see, this handout. What I was trying to tell you by those handouts, you know, it's useful. It's not normal that you have handouts at a book launch, but I figured I would do it in a more interactive way than you would expect. Those are quote-unquote Soviet jokes about China that were written in the or created, thought up in the 60s and 70s. I don't know what strikes you from the things that you read here. One thing that strikes me is the perception that China is somehow unsophisticated. This is one issue. It really comes across in several jokes. For example, here about number 22. Thank you. about the Russian cosmonauts. You can read it for yourself. Or number 24. You know, what is this? What are the Russians, when they tell these jokes to each other, what are they trying to tell? You know, one thing that they were trying to tell at that time is that how China is unsophisticated. The other thing that comes across from this sort of jokes is the Soviet fascination with numbers. That China is very populated. It has many people. And that is somehow perceived as threatening. You can see this, for example, from this one. Let's see. From number 18, the USSR declared the war in China. On the next day, 600 million Chinese surrendered, and the Soviet Union announced unconditional capitulation. You know, there's a fascination here, fear of Chinese numbers. There's a sense of aggressiveness in China's part, perception that the Chinese will come over and control, you know, take over Soviet Union. You can see it from the first one. Why did the Soviet delegation visit Finland? To ask for advice from the Finns about how to defeat a mighty neighbor in the East. This is, of course, a reference to the 1939 border war between the Soviet Union and Finland, when the Soviet Union was not exactly defeated, but came close to it. So you can, you know, those are the feelings, the perceptions that somehow were spread in the Soviet public in the 1960s, in the 1970s, and really all the way into the 1980s. China is unsophisticated. China is threatening. China is aggressive. China is big. These are all kind of negative perceptions. I was born on the border between Russia and China in a little Russian town called Lysozavodsk, where my mother was also born. And if you go from that town to the Usuri River, it's right on the Usuri River, and you can look across the other side. Actually, you cross the Usuri River, and then you look across. And what you see is a Chinese settlement there. And my mother used to tell me, you know, when she was growing up in that town, she said we would look across the border, and we would always laugh at the Chinese. She used this phrase, laugh at the Chinese, because they were, you know, so they seemed so primitive there on the other side of the border, right? The civilization had not reached it or whatnot, you know, poor. So they laughed at the Chinese. And now she said the Chinese are laughing at us, because now on the other side of the border you have a massive, you know, new Chinese development that reflects impressive growth of Chinese economy over the last few years. And on the Russian side of the border, the poor village of Lysozavodsk is just the same kind of slum that it was under the Soviet rule many years ago. So there's very interesting turning of tables here on the Russians. Well, so it is fascinating for me to study Russian-Chinese relations. Fascinating not only from academic perspective, but also, I should say, from personal perspective, because of how much my own life has been connected to China and to Russian-Chinese relations from all sorts of aspects and angles. Now, what do I say here in the book? The book is basically a history of the Sino-Soviet split. It says here, 1962-1967, and this is partially correct, although the book really starts in the 1940s, and then it gives an account of the Sino-Soviet alliance. When we talk about the Sino-Soviet split, it's worthwhile to remember that there was an alliance, there was something to split to begin with. And the book talks about it, talks about the golden years of the alliance, and the problems the Chinese felt as they developed their relations with the Soviet Union throughout the 1950s. Well, one big question that the book addresses is, when did the split actually begin? This is an important question, because depending on how you date the split, you take a certain perception or a certain interpretation of the events. A lot of people have said that the Sino-Soviet split began in 1956. The latest one is Lawrence Luthy, a good friend of mine who wrote a book also on the Sino-Soviet split that came out last year. He takes 1956 as basically the beginning of the split. Why is this? Well, because in 1956, as you know, Nikita Khrushchev made his secret speech at the party congress, which criticized Stalin. And this is supposedly the origin of Mao's disagreement with Khrushchev's line, because Mao felt that Khrushchev wrongly criticized Stalin. I take an issue with this interpretation. I say that 1956 is actually not a turning point in Sino-Soviet relations. An ideology and the quarrel over Stalin's legacy is not crucial to understanding of the Sino-Soviet split. And that's a very big point. I actually raise open a can of worms in the book, and maybe Professor Westad here will disagree with me on this. But I say there that Mao would have been glad if he led de-Stalinization. But he lost the initiative. Khrushchev started it, and Mao, rather than dragging behind Khrushchev, decided to go and lead the opposition. In other words, it was not specifically issue of de-Stalinization that drove Mao mad. It was specifically the fact that Khrushchev launched de-Stalinization that drove Mao mad. This is a very interesting point that the book talks about. Of course, we have to also acknowledge the fact that, de-Stalinization undermined Mao domestically. Because, of course, Mao was another Stalin. But so, in a way, Khrushchev was also another Stalin in some ways, after all. And Mao could have mitigated some of the bad effects of de-Stalinization. If he were able to take the leading role in de-Stalinization, he wasn't. Mao had boundless disdain for Khrushchev. Because who was Khrushchev? Khrushchev was a shadow of Stalin. He was a clown. In Stalin's entourage, he was known as the clown. The clown who was able to outmaneuver some of his much more smart competitors in leadership, people like Molotov, people like Beria. Khrushchev outmaneuvered all of them. But to Mao, he was a clown, because Khrushchev was a nobody. He was not involved in the making of the Russian Revolution, where Mao led a whole huge country to a revolution. So, of course, there was a personal element to the struggle, and Mao really was unhappy with Khrushchev. And this is an important reason for the Sino-Soviet confrontation. Now, one issue that Mao was very quick to point out in Sino-Soviet relations was the Soviet looking down on China. You can see it from this joke, right? You can see it. You can read it between the lines. What does it come down to? It comes down to a widespread perception in the Soviet Union at the time that the Chinese, they're not so good, look at them, they're backward, etc. This kind of feeling of looking down on China here in those jokes. Well, Mao felt it very keenly. You can see, actually, come up in very often quoted Mao's conversation with the Soviet ambassador, Pavel Yudin, in 1958 here, when the Soviets tried to create this joint submarine fleet and establish a radio station in Xinjiang for the benefit of both the Chinese and the Soviet submarines, or the joint operation of submarines. Mao was very unhappy with this proposal, called in Soviet ambassador and said, "You never trust the Chinese, you only trust the Russians. To you, the Russians are the first-class people, whereas the Chinese are among the inferior who are dumb and careless. Therefore, you came up with a joint ownership and operation proposition." Well, if you want joint ownership and operation, how about have them all? Let us turn into joint ownership and operation our army, navy, air force, industry, agriculture, culture, education. Mao is upset. He feels that the Soviets are looking down on him, are trying to control him. This is very important. We have to understand this kind of mentality. Why is he so upset? Well, because Mao represents behind him a century, the so-called century of humiliation. This is really weighing heavily on China, and Mao has this very sense, a very, very strong sense of nationalism, and he cannot afford to appear as if the Russians are somehow imposing something on him or that he's not equal to the Russians. This also comes out very clearly in 1959. This was a very high point of the Sino-Soviet confrontation when Khrushchev, after he visited the United States for talks with President Eisenhower and Camp David, came back to China, came back to Moscow, flew over to China for talks with leaders, with the Chinese leaders. And various scholars have talked about how Mao was unhappy that Khrushchev had gone over to the United States, and then after the United States, he actually went to China, as if the United States mattered more. Some scholars said it was because Mao was unhappy with peaceful coexistence, which Khrushchev was pursuing in Camp David. I think it mattered more with the fact that Khrushchev went to the United States first and then to China, and less with the issue of peaceful coexistence. Mao was unhappy in his second role of being after the United States. And what really turned things for worse was when Khrushchev, lacking really any kind of sense of Chinese sentiments, goes there to meetings with the Chinese leaders and tries to bargain for release of Americans who were detained by the Chinese. Americans were being held by the several Americans in charge of espionage were being held by the Chinese at that time, and Khrushchev tries to get the Chinese to agree to their release. This, of course, gets a very negative Chinese reaction, and we can see why. The Chinese did not need anyone, least of all Khrushchev, to help them deal with the Americans. The Chinese wanted to deal with the Americans directly. This is a very important thing. The Chinese were very unhappy with Khrushchev pulling out Soviet experts in 1960. Why? Not so much for the damage that they did to the Chinese economy, and more for the fact that that appeared like economic sanctions and pressure on China from the Soviet Union. And this is not something the Chinese leadership was willing to put up with. 1962, I take this, you know, the starting point of the book is officially the starting point. It's the turning point here. China's foreign policy was turning progressively to the left, towards class struggle. We have the Sino-Indian border conflict. There's escalation of polemics between China and the Soviet Union from late 1962 to 1963, and that really continued into 64. Polemics really got nasty. If you go back to the periods, to materials that were printed at that time by the Chinese and by the Soviets, it's just funny to read this stuff. You know, how they accused each other of all kinds of crazy, crazy sins against Marxism, Leninism. Khrushchev was very annoyed by the Chinese criticism of his actions in Cuba. Cuba Missile Crisis. The Chinese said, you know, Khrushchev committed a mistake in not being, in not having enough resolve to oppose the Americans in Cuba. Well, Khrushchev said to that, I quote, "What do you want? If we communist Soviet capitalist, we should pull out a knife and strike him? In this way, are we supposed to show the antagonistic intolerance for capitalism?" You know, Khrushchev had this feeling of disbelief. He was wondering, what were the Chinese trying to achieve by criticizing his handling of the Cuban situation? Was he supposed to go to nuclear war over Cuba? You know, he had this feeling that actually the Chinese did not want the war. That's interesting. You know, Khrushchev always accused the Chinese of being this warmonger and talking war. If we actually look at private papers, it turns out that Khrushchev thought that the Chinese did not want the war. He said that Mao Zedong, you know, Khrushchev said Mao Zedong did not want a war because he's afraid of war like devil of holy water. In fact, Khrushchev felt that there were no ideological disagreements at all between the Russians and the Chinese in the 1960s. Now, that appears very strange. If you go to the library, you pick up, you know, Beijing Review or whatnot for that time, or you read the Pravda articles, you think, oh, this is, you know, ideological disagreements. This is what drove them apart. Khrushchev himself thought that there were no ideological disagreements, and he kept asking, you know, what are they trying to say? You know, what are they accusing us of? We're doing the same thing as today. You know, what's the problem? Finally, when it came to the assessment of Chinese motivations, Khrushchev said, I know what they want. They want to, I quote, play the first fiddle. What is this? You know, that meant that Khrushchev thought that the Chinese wanted to take over his leadership in the sort of communist world and be number one. And this is an accurate assessment. I think Khrushchev was right on target. Yes, this is the case. the Chinese challenged Soviet leadership of the communist movement, objectively speaking. However, then what came out in some of the Politburo meetings that they had at that time is Khrushchev's very remarkable attitude towards Chinese pretensions to leadership. I'll give you a little quote that you get a sense of what Khrushchev was thinking of the Chinese efforts to undermine him. He said, "Even say among friends, 5 or 10 people, 5 or 10 people are friends and one of them is the chief. They do not elect him, they simply recognize him for some sort of qualities. There will be different colors and different characters and different mental capabilities among people, and there will be inequality in all species of nature." What is he saying here? Inequality in all species of nature, different mental capabilities, you know, between the Russians and the Chinese. What does that mean? That means Khrushchev believed that he was by nature entitled to lead. So this is basically social Darwinism a la Khrushchev and Khrushchev's interpretation. Can there be any more doubts why the Sino-Soviet alliance fell apart? Because the Chinese were not willing to put up with this. The Sino-Soviet alliance, I'll tell you here, for this one paragraph that I used to describe the book, fell apart because it was intrinsically and irreversibly unequal. It was a partnership of a superpower, the Soviet Union, with economically underdeveloped and militarily weak China. The Soviets regarded the structural inequality as entirely natural. In the Soviet-invented system of coordinates, China could only be second best, and that rule clearly did not suit the ambitious and intensely nationalistic Chinese leadership. The Sino-Soviet split was about China's efforts to escape the inequality of the alliance. So after that, things turned nasty for Sino-Soviet relations. Things really started to turn nasty after 1964. Actually, in July 1964, because of that moment in July 1964, Mao Zedong hosted the delegation of Japanese socialists, and when they were over, you know, he said that the Soviet Union, or the Tsarist Empire, when it was at its strongest, annexed large parts of China, including, he gave a very interesting bill of unsettled territories that went all the way to some territories where China was never even close, like Kamchatka. You know, up there by sort of by Alaska, but also Mongolia, Siberia, you know, all of that was annexed by the Tsars. This was all Chinese territory. And Mao said, "We have this unsettled bill with the Russians." That really scared the hell out of Khrushchev. Why did Mao Zedong make this unsettled bill speech to the Japanese socialists? I think this was to claim, I guess what Chen Jin would call moral superiority vis-a-vis the Russians. We have claims to the Russians. We're not going to pursue them, but we have claims. The fact that we're not pursuing those claims means that we're better than they. This is what he was trying to show. It's very clear. Now, Khrushchev's reaction to this statement by Mao Zedong shows overtones of quote-unquote yellow peril philosophy. Mao's remarks, Khrushchev said, hinted of war. And this was something really new in Sino-Soviet relations. It was one thing to try to seize the leadership in the international communist movement, and another thing to set the eyes on territorial expansion at the Soviet expense. Now, one of the things that came out directly out of this, of Mao's remarks and Khrushchev's reaction to that, was that Khrushchev decreed not to initial a territorial agreement between Russia and China. At that time, the Russians and the Chinese were engaged in defining their border, working out their border. They had border talks. And they worked out an agreement on the eastern section of the border. You know, they have western section they used to have. Now it's Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. There's a small bit of Russia there, just a couple of kilometers between Kazakhstan and Mongolia. On the other side, from Mongolian border all the way down there to North Korean border, there are huge sections of Sino-Soviet border. There were negotiations over those sections in 1964, and they agreed to delimit, to divide the border, to settle the border issue on the eastern section of the border, from Mongolia all the way to North Korea, huge section. And Khrushchev said, "Don't sign this," after Mao Zedong made these claims. And why is this significant? Well, I can tell you that continued, that border dispute later. First of all, in 1969, there was a border war there. If they had signed the agreement, there would not be a border war because the Russians were giving up Zhenbao Island by this agreement. They were giving up the island to the Chinese. Then the negotiations continued all the way into the 1980s, you know, the 1990s. In fact, the border agreement was only recently signed, finally delimited, right, delimitation agreement. The border agreement was signed in the early 90s. Now delimitation happened, and the final peace was resolved just a couple of years ago. So now that section of the border is fully determined. So that was one thing that came out of Mao's remarks. But there was also another thing. Mao's remarks made Khrushchev feel that there was some kind of a backstabbing here on Mao's part. And here we get back into this, the perception, public perception of China that you can see in this anecdotes about China and how that translated into actual policy, government policy. Now, this is something very important because up to now, you could talk about political factors, political relations between China and the Soviet Union, or you could talk about, say, racist attitudes in Russia, or maybe even some kind of racist attitudes in China towards Russia, vice versa. But you could not show how that affected policy because the actual Politburo archives and everything else was closed. Now this is open, and you can actually see how those public perceptions and deeply held mistrust that you can see in this anecdote, how that translated into policymaking in a very direct fashion. Well, one example that I show in the book here is I talk about Khrushchev's visit to Kyrgyzstan, that time Kyrgyzstan Republic, Kyrgyz Soviet Republic. Now, he went there, there's a lake there, Issyk-Kul, beautiful lake, if you've never been there, wonderful place to visit. There used to be a city there called Przewalsk. It's named after Russian explorer, whose name is Nikolai Przewalski, who's supposed to be the person who discovered the Przewalski horse in Mongolia. Maybe some of you have heard about him. Anyway, this guy Przewalski was a Russian explorer in the 19th century, and he traveled all across the Inner Asia and across northern China, tried to reach Lhasa, never was able to reach Lhasa, and died of dysentery or something near Issyk-Kul in Kyrgyzstan. And he was buried there, and where he was buried, there's a monument in the museum devoted to Przewalski. And actually, Przewalski, you know, there's an urban legend that Przewalski was the father of Stalin. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard about this? Because he looks so much like Stalin. When Khrushchev came to this the monument to Przewalski, first he thought, you know, what's going on here? Because he ordered to take down all the Stalin monuments in Russia, and here was another Stalin monument. And then somebody told, no, this is Przewalski. And he was suspicious for a while, but then eventually let it go. And then he went into the museum and looked at the materials about Przewalski. Now, the things that Przewalski wrote about China is quite nasty. Okay, you know, I'd hate to cite that, but you know, you can actually look it up. Actually, I will cite it, but the books were actually published here in England as well. You can read the English translation of this stuff published in the late 19th century. Treacherous and cowardly sets of thieves. They only respect force. They resort to dirty tricks and secret intrigues with hypocrite malevolence, obvious insincerity, and outright hostility. And also they have, he wrote, a thorough hatred towards the Europeans. And then the Russian explorer praised the quote-unquote moral superiority of the European over the degraded inhabitants of Asia. His contemporary explorer, Henry Yule, wrote at that time, he annotated the edition of Przewalski's work in English, and he dismissed Przewalski's words as wild kind of talk. But when Khrushchev visited Przewalski's museum many years later, he found that, I quote, what Przewalski wrote was like it was written today. And then he had a Politburo session. He was discussing China. You know, this was after Mao Zedong made those statements about the border issue. And Khrushchev said, you all have to read Przewalski. There he writes about the evil, hypocrisy, insidiousness, and cunning of the Chinese. And then Gromyko, you know, the foreign minister, he also said, added to this, Engels has it too. But although, you know, I was wondering about Engels, so I was reading some stuff on Engels, and the only thing that I found about Engels being racist is that he said, you know, the Slavs were sort of a backward race. This is very interesting, and you can see this kind of stuff later on. For example, in 1973, if you look at Brezhnev's meeting with Nixon, that's way after, you know, 10 years after Khrushchev had been dismissed, 9 years. Brezhnev spoke of the Chinese as, quote, treacherous and spiteful, not honorable, exceptionally sly and perfidious people, and he characterized Mao Zedong as a strange man with treacherous character who craftily concealed his real aims. This is with Nixon in 1973. And then on one occasion he told Kissinger, I believe, the Chinese are certainly beyond the capacity of my European mind to fathom. You know, Brezhnev, of course, thought himself as a European guy. And in fact, what's very interesting also about 1973, the meeting between Brezhnev and Nixon at that time, was that Brezhnev came to the United States with an agenda to conclude a pact directed against China. He perceived China as a very aggressive threat to the Soviet Union, and he essentially wanted a quasi-alliance with the United States against China. This is not the only instance that we see the Russians trying to develop this kind of anti-Chinese pacts. I would have to be careful with the use of the word pacts, but certainly some kind of relationship directed against China with other Western countries. And to me, this signifies the meaninglessness of ideology in this particular instance. Not that it was entirely meaningless, but what it means, essentially, that the Cold War, when one communist country, you know, seeks an alliance against another communist country with a capitalist country, that suggests something about the change in the nature of the Cold War, nature of the confrontation. Now, another thing that the book talks about, and here I draw on such strange archives as you would hardly believe it, Kyrgyzstan archives and Mongolian archives, is the Soviet military build-up with China in the late 1960s into the early 1970s. Now, the Soviet military build-up began as a result of Cultural Revolution in China. Not immediately as a result of Cultural Revolution, but because of the Cultural Revolution, there was an attack on the Soviet embassy and besieging of the Soviet embassy in 1967, early 1967. And as a result of this, Politburo took the decision to increase the forces on the Sino-Soviet border and also send troops to Mongolia. It was in 1967. Now, talking about this, after the confrontation on the border in 1969, when they actually had a conflict there, border war, Brezhnev commented about the military buildup. We assume that the stronger the defense of our borders, the less danger there is of really serious military confrontation on our eastern frontiers. Now think about it. We assume that the stronger the defense of our borders, the less danger there is of confrontation. So Brezhnev had this feeling of insecurity like many other Soviet leaders, and he wanted to overcome this insecurity by building up forces on the border. However, the more forces the Soviets built up on the border, the more insecure they felt, and that really fed into arms race and mutual insecurity on both sides of the border in the late 1960s, and eventually led, really, to the Sino-Soviet border confrontation at Zhanbaodao, and essentially that also led to reorientation of Chinese foreign policy towards rapprochement with the United States. Now, something that book talks about, that the Soviets were concerned discounting Chinese ideology very early on. They thought that the Chinese were after a rapprochement with the United States. They thought that already in 1966 they were thinking that what Beijing was waiting for was an opportunity to mend fences with the Americans. However, it is by their own actions that the Soviets essentially created the situation when China had no other choice but to seek a rapprochement with the United States. So it's very ironic how the Soviets messed up on this issue. Now, let me skip over to the 1980s. This is something the book doesn't talk about, actually, except briefly. But I have to tell you that I'm finishing a book now on the 1980s. It's the it's called, I don't know what it's going to be called, actually. But it's almost finished now. No, really, it's about the end of Cold War in East Asia. And one of the episodes that the book covers is a meeting between Deng Xiaoping and Gorbachev in May of 1989, so 20 years ago, just the time of the Tiananmen protest, Gorbachev was coming to Beijing to normalize relations. And he had this very interesting meeting with Deng Xiaoping, at which Deng Xiaoping discussed Sino-Soviet relations. So he started, blaming the Russians. Those Russians, they were oppressing China for many decades. And then he came to Sino-Soviet relations in the 1960s. And he talked about the polemical clashes in the 1960s, the ideological exchanges. And he said, the two sides said a lot of empty words at that time. The real problem, he said, was inequality. The Chinese people felt humiliated. This is Deng Xiaoping's assessment of the reasons for the Sino-Soviet split, which happens to entirely coincide with my own assessment. something that I want to say about this, about the 1980s. Am I out of time now?
No, it's fine.
Okay. Is that Gorbachev, unlike the previous Soviet leaders, was very, very careful to recognize that China was a great power and it had to be treated like a great power. He would say that on many occasions. He would say that at Politburo meetings, and here I can give you some quotes, and they're not in this book because they're in later book, but in any case, he said on one occasion, one has to understand the Chinese. They have a right to become a great power. We should not call it chauvinism. That's Gorbachev in about 86 or so. Speaking to the same cast of characters here, that's Politburo members, Gorbachev called on his colleagues to talk respectfully about China. He was extremely impressed with China's economic progress and believed that it was on its way up like India. Both, in his view, were getting stronger. Everyone can see it. That's a quote. Now, how Gorbachev came to these conclusions is a matter of debate. There's no doubt that such sentiments about China were fairly prominent in his close circle of advisors. People like Alexander Yakovlev, who was one of the sort of fathers of perestroika, would say similar things about China. I found very interesting comment by him, for example, in early 1988. He said, of course, we will not restore such relations as we thought we would have forever with the Chinese in the 1950s. They never do anything but harm. Eternal friendship never does anything but harm. One has to be a realist, Yakovlev said. China is a great power. If we talk about foreign policy, one must get rid of imperialist pretensions. This concerns us as well. One has to get used to living as equals among equals. So this kind of change in Soviet thinking, compare that to Khrushchev, what I was talking about, or Brezhnev. You can see the change in Soviet perceptions, change in Soviet thinking, certainly at the leadership level, what they were talking about, what they were saying. That, of course, was an important reason why the Soviet Union and China were able to mend fences in the 1980s. This is not the only reason. The other big reason, and maybe Arnie will disagree with me here or agree, I don't know, but I think that the Chinese foreign policy also began to change dramatically in the early 1980s with Deng Xiaoping feeling that he was not being treated well by the Americans, especially by Reagan. When Reagan administration came in, there was this deal with arms issue with Taiwan. There was the issue of selling high technology to China. Deng Xiaoping felt that China was being treated as some kind of a junior partner in this whole triangular diplomacy, and he would say things like, he didn't want to be played as a card by the Americans. Nobody had to be played as a card. So Deng Xiaoping also was unhappy with his relationship with the United States, and that's why in September 1982 he announced, actually even a bit earlier than that, he announced this independent foreign policy, or it launched independent foreign policy. The meaning of the independent foreign policy was that China wants to be equal with the others, with the United States, and for that reason also with the Soviet Union. And meeting the same kind of response from the Soviets by the mid-1980s, they were able to come to terms and develop something that they call now a strategic partnership. I'm not sure how sustainable that is, actually, but at least we can see that the Russians now approach the issue very differently from what the Soviets were approaching the issue like. So they learned from history. Now, some of the broader implications. I just want to mention one broad implication of this book. The book is called Two Suns in the Heavens. Why is it called Two Suns in the Heavens? There's a Chinese saying, I think I quoted here in the first page of the book. about there cannot be two suns in the heavens and there cannot be two lords on earth. Very old, you know. Tian Wu Er, Ti Wu Er Wang, old Chinese saying. What is the meaning of this? Well, basically, comes down to equality and inequality in international relations. What is the role of equality? What is the role of inequality? Now, with regard to the Russian foreign policy and the Chinese foreign policy, it's very interesting here. The Russians felt that they were more equal than the Chinese in this relationship. And yet, if you look at the Russian relationship with the United States throughout the Cold War, you see the same patterns that you see in the relationship between Russia and China, except the reverse of that. Now Russia felt that it was unequal throughout the Cold War. If you look at the beginning of the origins of the Cold War, Stalin, after the Second World War, wanted to be one of the great powers. He wanted to be treated as such. He wanted the United States to recognize that he was a great power, that he had a sphere of influence. Khrushchev also. Khrushchev was so keen to emphasize that the Soviet Union was a superpower on par with the United States, that, you know, the Soviet Union can bury the United States. Brezhnev, well, if you think about detente, if you study detente, you'll see that the reason that the Soviets so much wanted detente was to emphasize their equality with the United States. And this was very important to Brezhnev's mind. He wanted to be seen as equal with the United States. And I would argue that the same kind of logic is still implicit in Russian foreign policy today with regard to the United States. The Russians are feeling that they're not being recognized as equals. That's very clear in Russian foreign policy at various levels. And yet it's interesting that throughout the Cold War, the Russians looked at the Chinese as less equal than themselves. So anyway, I think I'll leave it at this stage, and I'll answer some questions.
Good. Thank you very much, Sergey. This is actually the first chance I have to discuss this book with Sergey after it came out. I've seen it in various incarnations earlier on, but it's the first time after the book's been published. I heard a lot about what other people have had to say about the book, which has been very, very laudatory. One fairly well-known U.S. professor of international relations, who shall remain unnamed, picked up the book, obviously because I was in his presence, and he said, there you see, he says, so he held the book like this. It's about power, pure and simple. You know, nothing to do with some of the stuff that I've been writing about. In other words, and I agree, having read the book, I agree with the first part of that statement, but not the second part. It is about power, but it certainly is not pure and simple. It's extremely complicated, and this is what I wanted to try to test you out on a little bit. The concepts of power, I mean, what actually goes into it. Because this is a book, as all books, that can be read at different levels. I mean, there are different issues that are at stake here. It changes over time, very obviously, and I think you do a fantastically good job in describing that. But it also changes in terms of content, in terms of issues that are particularly problematic. And the most problematic of all of these, of course, the concept of power in itself. What does this power and influence actually mean in a direct sense, both for the Russian side, which you have a great deal about with regard to this, and the Chinese side, which you have less about, because it's not as much in focus as the Soviet side is. So two questions with regard to it. You move far beyond the definition of power as simple one-upmanship. You know, I'm better than you, therefore I should have a better position overall. You try to test this out on a number of different concepts. And one of the most interesting ones is the concept of race. You know, racial stereotypes, racial images of each other. Now, I wonder now, when you finish this book and you move on to working on the later period in the Cold War, in the 1980s, how significant in both those kinds of settings do you think that that concept is for the Soviets and the Chinese, and how much does it change over time? And the second part of the and perhaps even more complex part of the power relationship is how it is expressed. Because much of this is about modernity, the Soviets having it and the Chinese wanting more of it, putting themselves into a position where it's possible to adopt some of Soviet modernity but without becoming Soviet, without becoming Russian in any sense. Now, how much of that do you think was understood on the Soviet side? Because that touches on your concept of ideology. Because if it wasn't about that, if it wasn't about getting something that was better for themselves, almost in a sort of raw physical sense, from the side of the Chinese, what on earth was it then that attracted them to the Soviet Union in the Soviet understanding of things?
Yeah.
So, yeah, power, absolutely, but certainly not simple.
No, it's absolutely not simple, and, of course, sometimes I tend to simplify it for the sake of argument.
Well, one of us has to do that.
Yes, yes. But it is very complicated, and, of course, ideology, this question of power and ideology, I do not really contrast them. I mean, ideology very much comes out here in the book, and the role of ideology, the role of sort of perceptions, on both sides, the role of race and culture. And then when we talk about ideology, one question that that I raise here with regard to ideology is, what is ideology? A very big question. If we talk about formal ideology, in other words, Marx and Lenin, is this ideology? Okay, Marx and Lenin, this is some kind of ideology because there was Marxism and Leninism. So if you take maybe what Lenin and Marx wrote, all the books, and say, okay, this is ideology. This is not the kind of ideology that I talk about in the book. Because if I have to talk about that kind of ideology, I would just plainly say it's irrelevant. Khrushchev never read Marx and Lenin. I don't think he read much at all during his career. Ideology is something different. Here we're talking about views, perceptions, how ideology is influenced as much by cultural concepts and racial concepts as anything else. And here in if we talk about Khrushchev's perception, then I think ideology is important. Now, as far as the issue of modernity. I would agree. And the Chinese looked to the Soviet Union because they thought that with the help of the Soviet Union, they would be able to modernize. Why? Because having modernized, they would become a great power.
But how did the Soviets see it? I mean, how did the Soviets perceive and understand that attraction that they had? Not just as a security guarantee, but also as a partner for the Chinese when we're talking about the 50s. What did they see at that point the Chinese as being after?
They obviously thought that the Chinese were after that. They were after the Soviet path to modernity, and they were right on that. The Chinese were after the Soviet path to modernity. And this is very true. So in the book, I don't deny that. What I say is this: it is somewhat irrelevant to understanding the causes of the conflict. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.